Welcome to The Daily Ben Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in at 4:30 every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of The Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by a slightly larger than normal panel. So let me go first to you, John Endres, our Chief of Staff. Dr. John Endres, how are you this fine Monday afternoon?
Very well, thanks. And yourself, Nicholas?
I'm pretty good for a Monday anyway. Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you?
I'm okay. That remark about larger than normal presumably refers to my waistline.
I know lockdown has not been good for my waistline. I was already slightly rotund, and now I am more rotund. And we are also joined, of course, today by someone who is appearing for, I think, the first time on any of our podcasts or shows, and that is Amy Clare, who normally works behind the scenes creating our video and helping us to actually be able to interact on the internet. Amy Clare, how are you?
Good, thank you.
So the reason we have Amy Clare on is because we are launching a new campaign at the IRR, and it is the hashtag Stop Citizen Abuse campaign. Now, I think I'm going to go to you, Amy Clare. What exactly is citizen abuse?
So citizen abuse is a phrase coined by our CEO, France Cunier, to describe the various abuses citizens are experiencing at the hands of the government. So that's like literal abuse, like what we saw at Marikana, or water cannons being turned on people waiting for disability grants.
Something or, which I can't believe didn't spend more time in the news because it was so insane. But sorry, carry on.
No probs. But it also includes stealing from taxpayers, undermining civil rights and freedoms, wasting resources and money meant for community upliftment, confiscating goods and assets of citizens, and also the crippling taxation that many South African citizens find themselves subjected to. So what we're saying with the campaign is let's stop citizen abuse by standing up to the government and say we won't tolerate anymore. Because if you think of it, the government needs South Africans' taxes to keep going. And in that sense, South African citizens are less powerless than it can sometimes feel.
Right, right. And it's important to remember that everyone is a taxpayer, as our CEO, France Cronier, points out, even the poor and the unemployed, because they pay VAT, which is often a significant part of their daily expenses, because it's on everything that isn't a basic foodstuff. So it's quite a burden, and it's an important part of their lives. Anyway, so what exactly is the IRR going to be doing? What are you going to be doing about citizen abuse?
Well, first of all, anybody who wants to join us in our standing against citizen abuse can visit our website and sign a submission form to join us in standing against citizen abuse. Our next step is to go to the union buildings on Wednesday, and we will be presenting the presidency with our 6-page memorandum on the matter. And in this memorandum, we lay out what citizen abuse is and what the government must do to stop it, which is cut out corruption, halt the expropriation drive, cease cadre deployment, and then use the savings that would ensue to cut taxes and pay the money back to South Africans. And we lay out for them what will happen if they don't do this. So basically, the government is pushing South Africans into a corner where we're crippled by taxes. Many South African households pay more than half their income to the state. And yet, when there's load shedding, we have to use our own generators. You have the situation like in Harry Smith, where the water heroes were a bunch of people from the community who got together and started fixing the sewerage and the water systems out of their own pockets. And you get into a kind of situation where people may start asking, if we're paying for all this ourselves, why should we be paying taxes on this? So we lay that all out for the government, that what this is leading to, what they need to do, and what citizen abuse is. And it'll be interesting to see how that turns out.
Right. It'll be interesting to see if you're able to get in and talk to anyone, or if they just stop you at the door. Anyway, we will have Amy Clare on tomorrow again to remind everyone about the campaign, introduce, just sort of talk about it, and then we'll have her back on Thursday to hear what happened when they visited the union building. So look forward to that. It'll be very interesting to hear from you, Amy Clare. And yeah, we'll continue on with the show as normal. Thanks, Amy Clare.
Thank you so much.
Right. So, gentlemen, what do we think of citizen abuse? What do we think of this new campaign that we're running? Terence, let me start with you. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, South Africans, I think I'm reminded of that line from Dr. Zhivago about how we never understood the Russian people's capacity for suffering. Now, okay, admittedly, this isn't quite Russia 1917, but South Africa, I think South Africa's population has shown an enormous fortitude. Good money has been thrown off to bad, as scandal has followed scandal has followed scandal. But you know, this has gone beyond a tragedy, and it's gone beyond a tragedy and beyond a farce. You know, to becoming something in the realm of an existential threat. And you know, I think one of the good news stories, you know, good news within a rather dysfunctional situation, are these citizen initiatives that have started to take up service provision by themselves. You know, while the municipality lies prostrate before its own incompetence. You know, this is a reality that we're faced with, and you know, we have to face it head on. So yes, I think this is. The moment has arrived where, you know, we either lead, follow, or, you know, get out of the way. Yeah, and we've chosen to lead this.
I'm rather surprised no one has actually kind of popularized a term like this before, because South African citizens' relationship to the state often is very, I mean, abusive is a good word for it, because so little is given. There's so much sort of scorn often poured on South Africans. I mean, the fact that water cannons were used on people standing in line for a disability grant is just insane. And then never mind all of the money that we have to spend on providing government services for ourselves, private education because South Africa's schools are so bad, private security because the police are under-resourced and not very good, all these things. I think a key part of what we're saying in this campaign, John, is that you're sort of, this tax boycott is inevitable, that citizens will inevitably have had enough of this if government doesn't do something. What do you base that? What do we base that sort of thought on?
I think just taking one step back to the water cannons being used against people waiting in queues for disability grants. Of course, what happened at the same time is that the minister was on the scene as well, in an armored vehicle, haranguing the people waiting in the lines and telling them to socially distance. And I think this is sort of a perfect image that encapsulates the relationship between the state and the citizens at the moment, which is that the high officials and ministers are very well insulated from the effects of their policies and are able to, you know, abuse citizens with impunity for years and nothing ever happens. It's an absolutely incredible story. It also reminds me of the food parcels during the lockdown, where so many private citizens, you know, took it upon themselves to help people in their own communities, people around them, through food drives, by collecting donations and so on. And the government, of course, wanted to take control of that, which is another, you know, form of citizen abuse. I'm also reminded of the pit latrines at schools. We have children drowning in pit latrines, which is, you know, an unbelievable scandal and horrific story. And it happens repeatedly. And repeatedly, the minister promises that pit latrines will be eradicated, and it doesn't happen. And I think this is exactly the kind of citizen abuse that we're talking about. It's this extreme callousness and disregard for absolutely unacceptable situations that we face as a country. And the reason why I think that the citizen abuse hashtag is a good one is because it links all these stories together. It's like a thread that runs through all these different scandals that we have in our country. And if you as a listener just follow the news over the next, you know, week or couple of weeks, you'll pick up the stories. You know, every day there's something in the news about a new scandal, some new project having been looted, you know, some job not having been done properly. And all of these are citizen abuse stories. They happen on a daily basis. It's continuous. It's ongoing. And I think, you know, it's absolutely right that an end should be put to this. And the way you put an end to it is two ways. And the one is that you demonstrate citizens' power versus the government. And you need to show the government that we're aware of this and we're connecting the dots. We can see what's happening. You know, we're not going to be fobbed off by saying this is an isolated incident that will be addressed soon and then it will be fixed. These incidents are not getting addressed. This abuse just continues. So we have to say, we see what's happening. We are going to publicize it and we are going to get people to stand up against it. And the second thing that's happening is relates to the question that you asked, which is that in many cases, citizens are already bypassing the government because the government is not delivering. And they're trying to insulate themselves from the government by providing private security, private schooling, private healthcare, trying to protect their assets as best they can. And there are limits to how much can be done in that area, because of course, as a citizen, you incur double costs if you're paying for public schools, security, healthcare through your taxes, and then being forced to do the same again on a private basis. And so you are able to protect yourself to a certain extent, but ultimately you still do suffer the consequences. And this high level of this high financial burden that you incur as a result of that is another form of citizen abuse. So I think this is a great campaign. I'm really happy that we're doing it. And I think many, many citizens will understand and resonate with this idea and join this campaign to stop it.
Right. No, I agree with that completely. I think if there's two sort of experiences of life in South Africa that basically every South African has at least a slightly shared experience of, whether they're black, white, poor, rich, old, young, whatever, it's crime and it's abuse by the government. Because all of us see that in different ways, even if not always to the same extent. So I think it's something we all share in common. And I think, yeah, it's time that we said enough is enough. This is can't continue on forever. Right. Let us go on now to our next story. And this is regarding the Minister of Police, Bheki Cele. Bheki Cele has in the past been quite, aggressive in the language he uses around with regards to police and criminals, which I think reflects the feeling of a lot of South Africans. But I just want to have a little bit of a discussion here. So there have been a significant number of police killed in the last 2 weeks. Six police officers have been killed. Two more were killed, I believe, on Sunday in Bloemkobos. Bheki Cele has said that officers are under siege, even more so in the Western Cape and KwaZulu-Natal. He said, quote, "There is war here. We must fight that war. For the fact that we have dead bodies here tells us that we are under attack." The latest attack on Sunday was in Cape Town and coincided with the funeral of another officer who was actually killed in Durban, a man called Constable Royal Ndlovu, who was attending a domestic complaint when he was killed. Cele also spoke at Ndlovu's funeral and said that officers should do whatever it took to safeguard themselves when confronted by criminals. Quote, "We must repel that and make sure that when the dust settles, we are not picking up the dead bodies of the police. We must pick up the other body, not the police's." So on the show, we often give the police a hard time because, as our colleague Gabriel Krauser often points out, they're one of the least trusted institutions in South Africa for good reason. They often don't perform a particularly good job. The police can at times be abusive. We've seen that. But we must remember, of course, that being a police officer in South Africa is very hard, and there are good policemen who are trying to make it work, and it's a very dangerous environment. So, John, I want to go to you, and I guess the question I'm going to ask is, Cele seems to talk in this very aggressive way, you know, we must basically kill the criminals. Firstly, is that particularly helpful? And secondly, it kind of seems a bit weak, because I think now, and there's numerous examples of this, the truck burnings on the N3. In which the police don't seem to have made many significant arrests, despite the fact that it's been going on for a long time and is a serious hazard. John, what do you make of that?
I think you're quite right. So I think the minister talks tough, but he's not really tough, not tough where it counts. I think he was tough on citizens during the lockdown, and the police caught over 200,000, I think 300,000 people that were arrested for contravening lockdown regulations. But in the meantime, this is the same minister who goes to have tea with Jacob Zuma while Jacob Zuma is defying the Constitutional Court and while he's defying the Zondo Commission. So I think Bheki Mhele is, you know, he talks as if he were in favor of law enforcement, but I don't think he really is. I think he's in favor of protecting his friends. I don't think that he particularly worries too much about the police officers. I think it's important to be seen to be caring. But if you think back to November last year, when Julius Malema called on his supporters to go visit policemen at their homes and attack them at home while they were off duty, what did Bheki Mhele do? Instead of, you know, laying a charge against Malema and taking him to task, he told his police officers they should take care of themselves. So, you know, you must protect yourselves if EFF supporters come in and you know, try to do harm to your families, which I think is completely insufficient, completely beside the point. I think this minister, this police minister, is another example of our politicized police force. And the mixing of the politics and the policing doesn't work. And it hasn't worked for 20 years, and it won't work in future either.
Exactly. Terence, your thoughts? The minister's comments, helpful or not?
Distinctly unhelpful. This is something that has a long pedigree. I remember, I think it was actually just before or just after President Mbeki became president, he was asked about this at a community meeting, and he cryptically responded that until the perception is dispelled that police are corrupt, we're going to have this problem. We've seen this tough talk come in waves. It was I think it was Susan Shibango who said, you know, shoot the bastards. I don't want warning shots. But courts do not like warning shots, by the way. Warning shots are extremely unpredictable, and they're more a sort of fantasy of the movies than a Hollywood myth than a crime fighting technique. Then there was Figeli and Balula, crush their balls and make them drink urine, the very ripe metaphor of Mr. Mbulula's is known and beloved for. South African policemen probably have one of the most dangerous jobs in the world outside of war zone. Violent crime has been on the rise for decades. The only thing pre and post democracy that really separated them was the decline in political violence, although that has popped up again in different forms. But you know, you have the sort of quasi organized stuff with taxis, for instance. You have an enormous amount of interpersonal violence, which when you throw a weapon into the mix, that becomes pretty lethal. You have quite significant organized crime penetration of the police services, and according to some police officers I've spoken to, training is wholly inadequate. So what you sort of end up with is the situation. I think it was Johnny Steinberg who wrote about this, that you have this kind of societal warfare, and police often see themselves as being almost at war with the communities that they're supposed to be serving, and vice versa. We had this idea of community policing in the 90s, which never really got off the ground. Then we went back to Krachtnadigheid, but you know, without the training or the discipline that might make that successful after a fashion. Plus, you know, in a constitutional society, you know, that's not the way you should be thinking. But survey after survey has shown that there is an enormous amount of insecurity on the part of ordinary people. And I think, you know, the easy sort of political response is to talk tough, whether that's crushing balls or, you know, we're going to pick up their bodies or whatever. It doesn't do very much, to actually stem the crime tide. And to be honest, I really don't know. Don't know what will. There was one analysis I read that said, think about crime in South Africa a bit like, you know, going to a dance. You know, first of all, everyone just stands around the floor, then a couple of people join in. And, you know, I think South Africa has in a sense become so lawless and this is over generations, that, you know, you have to break almost a almost a cultural cycle.
Right. And I think.
Yeah, I think I have no easy answers.
I think that's right, though. But one could start by, you know, creating jobs and opportunities so that people have things other to do than kind of get sucked into gangs and crime and all that kind of thing. Create healthier social structures, you know, encourage families to be created. I mean, we saw recently this, there was actually a news piece on the Daily Friend based on Stats SA data, which showed that I think it was something close to 70% of black kids are growing up without a father, which, and there's strong empirical evidence to suggest that that fatherlessness is related to crime.
Absolutely, you know, and I've often said that the great sin of apartheid and segregation was the breakdown was the effective assault on the African family structure. Mm-hmm. I remember Agri Cluster, I think it was even before the transition, saying with an air of poignancy that that is the tragedy of South Africa, and the additional tragedy is that we used to have strong family structures. The thing, though, is that this is not something that governments are particularly good at. You know, you can try and incentivize it, I don't know, with taxes or whatever, but, you know, ultimately, laws and governance does not piece together a social system.
That's why I bring up the jobs part of it, because I think that is a step in towards rebuilding.
No, certainly, yeah. Getting people to do stuff productive.
Right. Just I'll go to you, John, on this one. I think there is also a citizen abuse angle here too, right? Which is that, you know, the government has failed to run the police properly. It's, as you said, it's politicized the police. It's created the bad economic, or it's helped perpetuate the bad economic circumstances that many people find themselves in. And yet the response is, well, no, we should ban alcohol, because that'll push down the murder rate if people can't drink and fight with each other. It just seems like pushing the problem back onto the citizens, even though that's, I mean, keeping law and order is like the primary role of the state.
Yeah, that's quite right. I think we see quite a lot of developments that are almost like cries for help from the government or from its various institutions. And, you know, Bekinele, you know, talking tough, I think that's the only thing he can really come up with. You know, what else can he do? And, you know, the point that Terence makes about the greater social context is a very important one. I think Johnny Steinberg, in his analysis, wrote about the consent, you know, policing by consent. And he said there's no police force in the world that can do its job effectively if it doesn't have the consent of the people that, you know, it polices or where it polices crime. And we are in a situation where the police is distrusted, sometimes for good reason, and the consent is withheld. And no wonder policemen are scared to go into certain areas, because they don't know what's going to happen to them. They don't know that citizens are going to have their back. They'll be attacked by the citizens. And so ultimately, this is the problem you need to address. And one of the ways you do that is, as you say, through economic growth and creating opportunities, which would, I think, also help with the point that Terence made about fathers being absent. Because, of course, as a father, you also want to be able to provide for your family. As a mother, of course, as well. But if you can't get a job and you haven't got a means to sustain a family, you know, and meet all the obligations that come with that, it's very difficult to, you know, to know what to do. And I think we would see the double-headed or two-parent household numbers increase if there were more jobs in South Africa, because there would be far more fathers who would say, look, you know, I've got a job. I can take care of my family, of the mother and of the children. And also feel a sense of pride and achievement in that. And with that, right, crime could also come down, and probably the police would be able to do its job better as well.
Right, exactly. And when, you know, a lot of ways, crime is a young male problem, because that's who commits most crimes. And when you look at the unemployment rate for young people, young men, especially in South Africa, it's really horrific. You know, it's like over, I can't remember off the top of my head, but it's greater than 50%.
It's in the 60s.
Right. And, you know, if you don't have a job, you're probably just going to spend a lot of your time drinking and chasing girls and causing trouble rather than building your own life, which is a fast way to get into the criminal world. Anyway, let us move on now to our next door neighbor, Mozambique, who, when we've talked about this a bit on the show, there's been trouble in the north of the country. A branch of the Islamic State, they call themselves, I think, the Islamic State Central Africa Province, Central African Province, has been causing trouble in that part of the country. The Mozambican government has unsuccessfully tried to crush the insurgency there, and they took a port a while ago, and it still seems as though they are in control of that port. Terence, you've spoken to some experts on this topic. What are your thoughts about what's going on there in northern Mozambique?
So I think what you have to understand is that this isn't just a little bit of sort of lone wolf terrorism. When ISIS emerged in the Middle East, you know, the term state was the thing to notice, because it was actually running territory, and it was in a sense providing services and levying taxes, you know, in however rudimentary a manner. But yeah, that sort of mirrors the definition of a state. What you have in northern Mozambique is a significant insurgency, which has actually managed to capture territory and hold it to some extent, at least to the extent that it's been able to deny access to the nominal government of that of the country, access to that territory. The Palma area, for instance, I was reading today, the last convoy of provisions that was able to get through was like on the 7th of the month. That was 2 weeks ago. Mozambique has also had the bad fortune of bearing the brunt of the recent hurricane, and it has long-standing governance pathologies, corruption, whatever. Now it's banking
and we've seen the army abuse citizens in the area too.
No, absolutely. Well, citizen abuse. That northern part of Mozambique has traditionally been culturally distinct. Whereas most of Mozambique is nominally Christian, tends to be Muslim. It has a long-standing historical connection to the Gulf, to Somalia. It's also historically been neglected. You know, it's out of sight, out of mind. Development tends to happen. It's happened in the south, so neglected. Also, post-conflict society. There's lots of hired guns who've got very little else to do than go and offer their services, training and whatever. You have this ideological layer, which has at least some purchase on the local population, and even I understand within some of the local security forces, local police and whatever. There are also institutional conflicts in Mozambique between the police and the army, and there's elites from all of these groups hoping to get there to get their little slice of the action. Recently there's reports that that arms shipments apparently were coming in from the Gulf, from Somalia. Remember, you know, Islamist groups also have their footholds further north, and you know they're quite serious about consolidating this. Where you have potential for some sort of blowback. You know, even if these people are not particularly traditional Islamists, politically motivated religious extremists, it's there's enough frustration that enables that ideology to piggyback. What does that mean for the rest of us? Well, an unstable Mozambique has obvious impacts on South Africa, and South Africa is also, you know, by default, sometimes by choice, the regional leader. So if there's going to be some sort of regional response to this, South Africa is going to almost by default have to take the lead. Do we have the security forces to do it? That's a big open question. You know, there've been private contractors operating, guys who are used to fighting these sort of conditions. They found the insurgency a very tough nut to crack. It's also not a good set of choices.
Indeed. John, in 30 seconds, your thoughts on this insurgency?
In 30 seconds, I'll throw in the idea of consent again from a previous topic. And I think that in many cases, like with Boko Haram in West Africa, with Al-Shabaab in East Africa on the coast, the reason they are successful is because the local populaces accept them. And they accept them because they replace the functions that a failing state fails to provide, like, for example, security, like, for example, education, like, for example, health, like, for example, employment. And therefore, I think this is what makes it very difficult to shift these insurgencies, because they are, you know, in many cases, even though they are oppressive, etc., they do fulfill some functions that the state no longer provides, and therefore people are receptive to them. So make it very difficult to fight.
I think that's a very good point. And I think it's a warning about, South Africa, where citizen abuse continues. I don't know if we'll have an Islamist insurgency, but there are plenty of ideas floating out there in the ether that will convince people to start taking up guns and shooting at others.
Yeah.
Anyway, if you'd like to read more about the citizen abuse thing, our CEO, Frans Krenier, has written an article, which is on the dailyfriend.co.za, which you can go and check out. He lays out the concept and why we're launching this campaign. And if you like this podcast, please like us, please share us, please leave us reviews on iTunes or Spotify or wherever. Thank you very much for listening, and we will see you tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Have a great day, everyone.